The third lymphoma expert I interviewed for this program was Dr. Brad Call, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Director of the Lymphoma Service at the University Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. Dr. Call is principal investigator of one of the major national trials in this disease. The RESORT study is evaluating the use of rituximab or Rituxan in patients with so-called indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Dr. Call began our conversation by providing an overview of this condition.
Indolent lymphoma is referring really to a group of diseases, and the term indolent is referring to the natural history of the disease. In other words, what would happen if no treatment was administered? And in the indolent lymphoma setting, patients can live for a long, long time in general without any treatment.
And I guess that's totally counterintuitive to what we think about when we think about cancer.
Most people, when they hear the word cancer, I have cancer, they think it's a death sentence. And it's actually not the case for the vast majority of patients who are diagnosed with any of the indolent lymphomas. It's just not the case. There are a variety of indolent lymphomas. The most common would be what's called follicular lymphoma. That term really just refers to how it looks under a microscope. There are some other indolent lymphomas, and what we as physicians are learning more and more is that these lymphomas are different biologically. They respond differently to treatments, and more our treatments are tailored to specific lymphoma subtypes. And that's probably a useful thing for patients to understand. So 10 years ago, most new treatment trials would just lump all the indolent lymphomas together. But nowadays, you're seeing more and more where the trials are separated and a trial will be designed just for follicular lymphoma or just for small lymphocytic lymphoma, which is another indolent variety, or just for MALT lymphoma. So there's a little more of that happening now, which is an important thing for patients to understand what kind of lymphoma is my indolent lymphoma.
What is the objective of treatment? I mean, if the disease really isn't going to threaten the patient, why treat?
Well, the number one objective is to prolong the overall survival. In other words, we want our indolent lymphoma patients to live as long as they possibly can. Because the fact of the matter is, most patients who are diagnosed with an indolent lymphoma will die as a result of that diagnosis. And so you have to be careful here. Because it's indolent, that's generally considered to be a good thing. But I've heard some physicians explain to patients, don't even think of this as cancer. I think that's the wrong message, frankly. Indolent lymphoma will shorten patients' life expectancy, and that's what we need to improve upon.
Although in patients who are older, perhaps they might end up dying of something before that happens.
That's exactly right. And so the management of an individual patient really has to be tailored. And if you have older patients, it is quite possible, could be even probable, that they would die of something other than their lymphoma long before the lymphoma would cause problems. So particularly for those patients, it's important to not overtreat the lymphoma because it could result in a detriment to their quality of life unnecessarily.
At what age would you say you start thinking about the fact that maybe this is really not going to be the problem that ends up taking their life?
Well, the median survival for most of the indolent lymphomas, and I'm lumping them now, it's not the same for all of them, but it's usually around 7 to 10 years. It would be a little better than that for the MALT lymphomas, a little worse than that for the small lymphocytic lymphomas, and that would be pretty much on the mark for follicular lymphoma. So if a patient is diagnosed in their 70s with this disease, I think there's a reasonable chance that they will have a normal life expectancy. But if you're diagnosed in your 60s and you're otherwise healthy, then there's a relatively good chance that this disease will be the thing that shortens your life expectancy. Then we've got a problem that needs to be addressed.
You mentioned MALT lymphoma. Can you explain what that is?
MALT is an acronym, M-A-L-T, and it stands for mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. This is a unique group of lymphomas that arises in any place but a lymph node. So typically we think of lymphoma as a disease arising in lymph nodes. But the fact is, any place in your body that has lymphocytes is a place where lymphoma can arise. And the fact is you have lymphocytes in every nook and cranny of your body. And so people can get lymphomas arising in the skin or in the lungs, in the liver, in the stomach, in the small intestine, in the colon, in the conjunctiva, the eye, you name it, a lymphoma can appear there. And these malt lymphomas arise characteristically in places that don't normally contain lymphoid tissue, like the lungs, like the stomach, like the conjunctiva, the breasts. These are places where malt lymphomas typically appear, skin, for example.
Do we know anything about the cause of the malt lymphomas as opposed to the other types of indolent lymphomas?
There's one variety of malt lymphoma called gastric malt lymphoma, gastric meaning arising in the stomach. And that entity is highly linked to a certain infection with a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And it just so happens that about 90% of gastric malt lymphomas appear to be due to this chronic infection with this bacteria called H. pylori. And the remarkable thing is that once detected with just eradication of the bacteria
by antibiotics,
antibiotic therapy, the lymphomas will regress about two-thirds of the time. So there's a group of patients who might never need chemotherapy or radiation and can actually be treated for their cancer with antibiotics.
So that's kind of a sort of outline of the indolent lymphomas. And I take it that the issue then is the oncologist will look at a lot of different issues and decide whether or not treatment is needed or whether or not they can just be observed.
Exactly. Observation is something that we often do in patients who have a new diagnosis of indolent lymphoma. It's actually a hard thing for patients to accept, to be told they have a diagnosis of cancer and then be told, but we're not going to do anything about it right now. And that's very understandable that that would be hard to accept. But the fact is, studies have addressed this question. And so there are a couple of studies now in which there were newly diagnosed patients, and half the patients went on to receive chemotherapy right away, and the other half of the patients went on to observation right away. And if you look at the proportion of patients alive at 5 years and at 10 years, it's identical in both groups. And so based upon that, it's reasonable for selected patients to just watch initially. There really hasn't been a proven benefit to jumping in with chemotherapy. As long as the patient is not symptomatic from the disease, and as long as they don't have a high tumor burden, meaning very large lymph nodes that look like they could start to cause problems in the near future.
So for those patients, perhaps a patient who might be a little bit younger or a patient who has a lot of disease or who might have symptoms from the lymphoma where a decision has made to use some type of treatment, can you talk about then where the option of participating in a clinical trial comes in that they might consider entering?
Sure. Well, I would encourage patients to always ask their doctor about the opportunity to participate in clinical trials. Honestly, every advance that has been made in the past 40 years in the war on cancer is a result of testing of new agents or new combinations in the setting of clinical trials. And everything we know today about what to do is derived from that. And if we don't continue this, then there will be no further improvements for current patients or their loved ones or their children.
So you're saying that a motivation to be in a trial is to help future patients?
That's exactly right. I've actually had a few patients say to me how much satisfaction that they derive from just that fact, that they knew that they were getting state-of-the-art care, that we were trying things that were hot off the shelf, that were new, that were promising, and yet at the same time they knew that they were helping others at the same time.
Do you think there's a benefit to the patient themselves who's in the trial from their own point of view?
I think by and large, yes, there is. For the most part, the trials are using drugs that are already proven, but we're just trying to optimize their use. We're trying to fine-tune how best to use them. That's typically the case if it's a trial for a patient with a new diagnosis and is being treated for the first time. Or alternatively, sometimes you get into the situation where a patient has already been through some standard treatments and the disease has come back and maybe the options for treatment aren't so plentiful now. And by participating in a trial is a way for a patient to get access to new agents that are trying to kill the cancer cells in a brand new way. So there are a couple different ways patients can benefit from clinical trial participation.
And I guess it's important for every patient to know that there's certainly no obligation or pressure whatsoever to be in a trial.
That's right. It's completely voluntary, and if patients choose not to participate in a clinical trial, their doctor will still treat them the very best way they know how to treat them with available agents.
Now, in this situation that we're talking about with a patient who's about to receive their first treatment for an indolent lymphoma, we want to talk about two studies that they might consider going into, one of which that you're actually running and another trial. Can you talk about sort of the way these studies are broadly set up in terms of the idea of randomization?
Okay. So there are two large studies going on right now in the United States for patients with indolent lymphoma, and they're both what are called randomized clinical trials. And the idea here is that two treatments are being compared against one another. And which treatment the patient receives on that trial is not chosen by the patient, and it's not chosen by the doctor. It's actually chosen by a computer. A lot of patients have trouble with this concept, or they're uncomfortable with this idea that their treatment choice is being decided by a random assignment. It's important to explain to the patients why we do this. Typically, when we're doing a randomized clinical trial, we feel like we have two very good treatments, two outstanding treatments, or at least two state-of-the-art treatments. And what we're trying to do is to decide if one is a little better than the other, to see if we can establish the new standard. And so the way I explain it to patients is I think you'd be getting very good treatment in either case. One of them potentially could be a little better than the other, but I honestly and truly do not know the answer to that. I don't know which one is better, and that's what we're trying to answer in this clinical trial.
And I guess if a physician sort of has a belief or a feeling that one therapy would be better for the patient than the other, probably they shouldn't be in the study.
That's exactly right. So if the physician feels like because of that patient's disease or their characteristics, like one of the treatments would be more appropriate, then the physician is obligated to say that to the patient, and it wouldn't be appropriate to put them on the trial.
Is there a financial incentive to physicians for participating in trials like these?
Absolutely not. The trials come from a variety of sources. A lot of the trials are sponsored by what are called cooperative groups. And cooperative groups are large organizations of cancer centers and private practice oncologists who band together to try and answer important clinical cancer treatment questions. Those trials are funded by the National Cancer Institute. In other words, it's the patient's tax dollars that are funding those trials. Some trials are funded by the pharmaceutical industry. And the fact of the matter is, all new treatments for cancer have to come eventually from a company. There has to be a company with an interest in a new treatment if that treatment is going to go anywhere. But the companies themselves don't get to choose the patients for the trials. And so what they do is they provide the drug to the physicians who conduct the trial. Now, the physician's office or group might get some financial remuneration for the conduct of the study that would be used to pay study coordinators, data managers, but physicians don't derive income from clinical trial participation.
Yeah, what I've heard physicians talk about is the fact that they like participating in the trials for their scientific value, for contributing to the field. I've heard people say they like them because they, you know, it adds a little more interest to their own practice. Some physicians I've heard say, well, you know, it increases the profile of my practice in the community if people know I'm participating in research. But this isn't really a way for a physician to generate significant dollars in terms of income.
That's correct.
So why don't we start with a trial that you are running?
Sure.
If you can talk a little bit about sort of what went into the thinking and then what happens to the patient who goes into this study.
So I'm the principal investigator of a trial that's being conducted all over the United States right now. It's called the RESORT trial. And it has a number, too, and that's ECOG study 4402. So if one were to look it up on, say, a website, they might find it under that heading.
And you can find that in the NCI, National Cancer Institute website, and also the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, ECOG website.
That's correct. And the RESORT trial is a study that is looking at two different ways to give the drug Rituxan to patients with indolent lymphoma. So Rituxan is a monoclonal antibody that targets a protein on lymphoma cells that's called CD20. Rituxan is an attractive agent for indolent lymphoma treatment because it doesn't have a lot of the side effects and toxicities of chemotherapy. And Rituxan has really changed the way we treat lymphoma. There's a lot we don't know about Rituxan, particularly how best to dose it. So there have been some small studies now that have suggested that if a patient gets the drug Rituxan, that if they just keep getting it on a scheduled basis, perhaps that's a better way to control their disease, to keep it in remission, and to keep the disease from causing problems. On the other hand, it's not so clear that prolonged exposure to the drug on a continual basis like that is truly the best way to control the disease and keep it from hurting the patient. And it's possible that just giving the drug intermittently when the patient really needs it, because the disease starts to grow again, might be the best way to control the disease in the long run.
And this is given intravenously?
It's given intravenously. It's an infusion. When the patients get their very first treatment, they get it 4 weeks in a row. And for the patients who get the drug intermittently, then they would get the 4 weeks in a row every time the disease starts to progress.
Initially, they get the 4 weeks, and then it would stop.
That's right.
And you wait until usually the tumor would respond, would shrink down.
That's right.
And then they wouldn't get any more of the
Rituxan. They wouldn't get any more until we saw signs of disease progression, which on it could be 12 months, could be 18 months, could be longer. So they could have a long period of time free of any treatment in remission. That would be the standard way to give Rituxan. That would be the traditional way. The way that we would consider the experimental way or the newer way would be to give it and continue to give it. In other words, try and keep the disease in remission. Don't let it recur. And in this trial, after the 4 weekly doses and the response, patients then get a single dose every 3 months, essentially indefinitely, until the disease starts to grow back despite the fact that the patient is continuing to get Rituxan. And that's called rituximab scheduled, or another term for it is maintenance therapy.
And also, I guess it's worth pointing out that in general, if a patient weren't going to go onto this study or trial and was going to be treated, almost for sure they would get Rituxan either alone or with chemotherapy.
That's right. The current standard of care in the United States is to give Rituxan either as a single agent or with chemotherapy.
And so this trial is attempting to sort of refine down what might be the best way to give it.
Right. Now, an important point about this trial is that this trial is restricted to patients who have what we call low tumor burden. Rituxan is a great drug for patients largely because of its favorable safety and side effect profile. It is not as active, however, as most chemotherapy drugs. So the probability of getting into remission is higher with an aggressive chemotherapy regimen.
Chemotherapy alone or with rituximab?
Either. And so if patients really have an indolent lymphoma that's acting more aggressively, or they've got symptoms from the disease, or they've got big, large, bulky lymph nodes, it's probably not appropriate to get single-agent Rituxan without chemotherapy.
So in essence, this is a situation where a patient might get Rituxan who's not on the trial, but they would go into the trial and have it randomly determine which of these two ways it would be given.
That's right. And a typical scenario would be a patient who's diagnosed with follicular lymphoma, who has low tumor burden, has no symptoms, they feel fine. Most people, most physicians would initially watch that patient, which is appropriate. Well, let's say you watch them for a year, and then they come in for a visit, and it's clear that things are progressing. The lymph nodes are growing, and you're thinking to yourself, at this rate, this patient is going to be probably requiring chemotherapy within the next 6-12 months, that would be an appropriate patient for the resort trial. You could come in at that time and treat them with single agent Rituxan. They wouldn't be getting any chemotherapy, and no matter which treatment arm they were assigned to, they would be getting treatment with Rituxan. And what we're really interested in seeing is which strategy delays that patient's time to chemotherapy. We think ultimately it would be to the patient's advantage if we could delay their time to chemotherapy, because there are some negative quality of life issues that occur when patients move on to chemotherapy. So if we can delay that, we think we'd be doing a good thing for that patient. With Rituxan, probably the most common side effect is what's called an infusion reaction. And that, if it happens, typically occurs with the first infusion. And people can have fevers, shakes, chills, shortness of breath, pain at tumor sites, itching, throat swelling. I mean, it can seem all the world like an allergic type reaction.
Now, this is during the infusion?
It's during the infusion while you're at the doctor's office. And we're very used to seeing it, and the way we manage it is we give Tylenol and antihistamines before the infusion. If people start to have a reaction, we turn the drug off and we just sort of let things cool down, and then we just run it in at a slower rate and we increase the rate more slowly. So the first infusion can actually take a while. It can be a 6 to 8 hour experience if the patient is having problems with reactions.
And if they are having problems with reactions, how do they feel by the time they get out of the office?
Usually they're pretty wiped out because we've usually repeated their antihistamine, their Benadryl, so they're tired because they've gotten a lot of antihistamine and it's a long day. So if a patient ever has trouble with Rituxan, it's on that first day in the office. Usually by the next day, they feel just fine.
And in terms of the intensity of what this feels like from what it's been described to you, is it kind of like the flu, worse than the flu, or not as bad as the flu?
You know, the reactions are very variable. And so for some patients, it'll be worse than the flu, but it's for a short period of time. But for most patients, it wouldn't be that bad.
So people don't come back and say, this is a horrible experience, and or do they?
Very rarely they'll come back and say, that was terrible. Most of the time, they get through it quite easily. But the good news is, even if it was terrible, it's very unlikely to happen with the second and third and fourth infusion. It's not an allergic reaction. It's a different phenomenon. And so it's very rare to get infusion reactions once you get beyond the first infusion.
What exactly is going on then if it's not an allergic reaction?
So there's a system of proteins in our body that's called complement. It's part of our immune system, and we have a lot of these complement proteins in our circulation. So when a patient first gets Rituxan, the Rituxan is binding to B cells that are circulating in our blood, and that triggers this complement system, and that releases all of the chemicals in our body that we release when we get the flu. They're called cytokines, and so it causes a whole cascade of symptoms that would be sort of flu-like. But by the time you come back for the next infusion, all of those B cells that were in your blood are basically have been cleared out by the Rituxan. And so this infusion reaction just doesn't occur with later infusions.
So getting back to the trial, so then the patient would have to agree to sort of allow the computer to determine which way the Rituxan is going to be administered.
Yes, that's right.
How do patients respond to that idea?
A lot of patients are initially very uncomfortable with the idea of randomization, and that's understandable. Once I explain the process to them, they're usually a little more comfortable with it. Randomized clinical trials are really the only way that we as oncologists can determine if a new regimen is better than an old regimen. There's no other way to do it and be confident that you're getting the right answer. And the reason is there's always the potential for what's called bias in trials. So this has happened repeatedly in the history of oncology, where a group of investigators at a single institution will come up with a new treatment for some cancer, let's say lymphoma, that they think is really promising. And they recruit patients from their own institution into that trial. And either intentionally or unintentionally, they end up recruiting patients who are younger, who are healthier, whose disease isn't so bad. And all of these things influence the outcome. So when they report the results, their reports look really good. And people might then run around and start giving that regimen based upon the results of that institution's results that were published and that look so promising. And this actually happened in the 1980s in a different kind of lymphoma called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There were three chemotherapy regimens that were much more aggressive and complicated than the standard regimen that was called CHOP. And based upon small single institution or limited institution studies, these three regimens all looked much better than CHOP, very superior to CHOP, to the point where people basically stopped giving CHOP chemotherapy for a period of time in the 1980s and were using these more complicated regimens that were frankly more toxic. But doctors believed that they were curing more patients based upon these published results. Well, the National Cancer Institute, led by one of the cooperative groups called the Southwest Oncology Group, got around to doing one of these randomized clinical trials that we're talking about. And the patients were randomly allotted to one of four treatments, one of the three more complicated toxic regimens, or CHOP. And when that trial was ultimately reported, it turned out that the results were identical for the four regimens. In other words, the cure rate was no higher with the three more complicated regimens, and yet there were a lot more side effects and toxicities. And so for years, doctors were under the delusion that they were curing more patients, and they really weren't.
And they were exposing them to more problems.
They were exposing their patients to more side effects and more toxicities. And we don't want to make those same mistakes over and over again, which is why now we really demand that before we accept a new regimen as an improvement over the old regimen, it really must beat the old regimen in a randomized clinical trial.
And, you know, we all hope and we're looking to advances in therapy. They're going to improve cure rates, improve survival. But when you think about it, those, I don't know, several hundred patients who participated in that study really had a tremendous impact on subsequent patients. There have been thousands and thousands of people treated since then who didn't have to experience
That's
the
right.
side effects of the more toxic regimens.
Those patients were heroes, truly.
When you talk about, let's say, patients in the United States, for example, and this trial that you're talking about is an Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, but it's also throughout the United States. Can any oncologist theoretically participate in this study and put their patient on it?
Yeah, actually they can with this resort trial. The trial was initiated in a group called the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, and only certain institutions are members of that group, but there is a new mechanism available that's called the Clinical Trials Support Unit, or CTSU. And the CTSU is an office that's funded by the National Cancer Institute to get trials like this available to all centers, all sites throughout the United States, no matter what that site's cooperative group affiliation is. So any office that has the capability of doing clinical trials can do trials through the CTSU, and the resort trial is available through the CTSU.
So this is like, I'm thinking about some of the commercials that you see that pharmaceutical companies put on for various products, and maybe we could do a little commercial for clinical research by saying that maybe patients with indolent lymphoma ought to say to their doctor, are you part of the ECOG? Do you know what the CTSU is?
Right.
I mean, have you ever heard of the ECOG? What's the number again?
4402.
Trial.
It would be, you know, educated patients are actually, by and large, a joy. Occasionally you get patients who probably have read too much and they're just confused, but by and large, educated patients are better consumers. They ask the right questions. It's easier to explain these concepts to them. And, you know, I think anything we can do to educate our patients so that they're more informed is a good thing.
Well, I guess the other thing is that as much confidence as a patient might have in their oncologist, there's always sort of a value in a second opinion. And in a sense, being in a trial kind of provides that because all their data is going to go into a center. Mm-hmm. They're going to check and see if they're really eligible for this therapy. There's sort of another set of eyes looking at them when they're therapy.
That's true. And the fact is that the trials undergo intense scrutiny before they're even able to be opened. I mean, they undergo review at so many levels for scientific merit that I think physicians can feel very safe when they're opening a study that it's scientifically sound, and patients can feel safe that what they're being offered is considered state of the art.
Well, also that it's ethically sound.
Exactly.
And I know there are committees that review these trials to see, is it really ethical to do the study and do this kind of randomization? And again, there are a lot of eyes that I see on the study designs and how they're run.
I totally agree with what you just said.
You know, I'm sure you've talked to lots of patients about the possibility of participating in these randomized trials. In general, do most patients that you ask participate, or do some of them just say, hey, I'd rather not do that?
Not everyone participates in clinical trials, and patients have every right to decline participation, and if they do, their doctor will continue to treat them in the very best way they know how. In fact, there may be settings where there isn't a trial available for a given patient at a given moment in time, or where a trial wouldn't be appropriate. That can happen too. But there are also many settings where there is a trial available and it would be appropriate, and it would behoove patients to ask their physician, do you have any clinical trials available for me right now that you think would be appropriate?
And I guess one of the things that we've seen in general with cancer research is that actually relatively few patients enter clinical trials. Even if you look at those who are, there is a trial available, relatively a small fraction end up getting in trials. Is that your impression?
Yeah, it's kind of sad. It's sort of unique to adults in the United States. In Europe, patients are much more likely to participate in clinical trials, particularly randomized clinical trials. And a lot of the progress, especially in lymphoma, that's being made right now is being made by our friends in Europe rather than the United States leading the way, which is not the way it should be. Pediatric oncologists are much better about having their pediatric cancer patients participate in clinical trials. And it's amazing. Probably 80 to 90% of all children diagnosed with a cancer will participate in a clinical trial. And if you look at the pediatric cancers, they have made steady incremental improvement in almost all of their diseases over the past 30 years. Now contrast that with adults in the United States, and the figure that I most often hear is that it's about 5% of adults with cancer participate in a cancer clinical trial. And there are a variety of diseases where we have made very little progress in the past 30 years. And that's probably the biggest reason. It's the lack of participation in clinical trials. So we can't get questions answered. We can't figure out if we're making improvements. We can't test new ideas. It's a huge barrier to progress.
It is frustrating, and everybody has their own sort of theory about what the obstacles are or why this occurs. What's your take on it?
I think that there are a variety of obstacles. I'll just speak candidly about them. The system of oncology care in the United States is not super well equipped to deal with clinical trials. The majority of patients are treated in private practice oncology offices, which are extremely busy, and a lot of patients coming through every day. And to put patients on trials takes time. It takes a lot of time. If it's a randomized trial, not only do you have to explain one treatment to the patient and all the side effects, you have to explain two treatments and all the side effects.
And you have to go through a big, long form.
There's a consent form that the patients take home. Whenever I talk to a patient about a trial, I try to explain it to them as best I can. I give them the consent form, and then I make an arrangement that we'll talk by phone in a few days after they've had a chance to read it. So it results in a long clinic encounter as well as follow-up phone conversations. But I want them to understand what is being asked of them. And I don't think all physicians in the United States have the wherewithal or the motivation to spend that much time putting patients on trials. It really adds a lot to a busy physician's day. There's one barrier.
And, you know, to some extent, I hate to say this, but sort of time is money.
Time is money. It's absolutely true. And if a private oncologist's office is going to do trials, they have to hire research people. That costs money as well. So there is possibly a financial reason why the accrual isn't as good. You know, the fact is that just about every child that's diagnosed with cancer is treated at an academic center. And I think that's one of the reasons that more of them get on trial. So, I mean, one of the things that we really need to do in the United States is to incentivize the whole process for the private practice oncologist so that we don't have these barriers. And most of the patients who have been asked about clinical trials and why they didn't do them, it was because it was never presented as an option.
Yeah, we've polled patients with a variety of cancers, and that always is what we hear. At least 2/3 have never even heard about a clinical trial. I guess the other issue is, particularly as it relates to the randomized trial, that the physician has to be comfortable that either way is okay. I've heard the term equipoise, which is that there's an equal feeling about that. And I guess a lot of physicians have their own bias that they think one treatment might be better than another.
Right. That's a huge thing to overcome. For me, it's a very frustrating thing because usually by the time something gets to a randomized trial, the literature is pretty clear that there isn't a better treatment, and overcoming the bias among individual physicians is a hard thing to do. But they just need to understand that the bias isn't helping the process.
Another thing that relates to these trials is There's more to it than just trying to find out sort of which treatment might be better in these randomized trials. You're also looking inside the tumor to see if you can learn things about the lymphoma that might correlate with treatment.
The other thing that sometimes is hard for physicians, if you're putting a patient on a randomized trial, you're basically telling that patient, I don't know what's best for you. And it's actually easier to take a more paternalistic tone with the patient and say, this is what's best for you. I know what's best. This is what you need.
And a lot of patients are asking for
that's right. That inspires confidence from the patient. And when you do a randomized clinical trial, you can't do that. You literally have to say, here are two treatments. They're both good. I don't know which one is better. You have to be comfortable saying that to your patients, and they have to be comfortable with that fact. And that is another barrier. Getting back to the question you just asked, yeah, we're entering a new era now in cancer therapy, and the term that we hear most often is the area of targeted therapy. And there's a couple of drugs right now that are very good examples of that. And we're hoping to get away from the day where we give chemotherapy, which is more of a shotgun approach to treating cancer, and we'd like to have more rifle approaches. And you need treatments that are targeting aspects of the cancer cell that are unique, proteins or biochemical pathways that are unique to the cancer cell that are not present on normal cells, whereas chemo just kills cells that are growing fast. Well, for targeted therapy to work, you need to know what the target is. And to know what the target is, you really need to get inside the cancer cell. And that's one of the things that goes with clinical trials. We very often will be obtaining tumor tissue from the cancer cells or from the patient's blood that allows us to do what we call correlative studies. And it helps us figure out why the drug worked for these 10 people and it didn't work for these 10 people. And then it helps us figure out where to go next when we're able to do these correlative studies and try and link that to the clinical outcome.
Let's talk a little bit about other types of clinical trials besides these randomized studies. What about other kinds of clinical trials that aren't randomized?
So we usually apply the term phase three when we're talking about randomized clinical trials, but there's actually two phases of study that come before that. So just to sort of take you through the process of drug development, let's say that there's a new compound that gets synthesized or discovered, and it typically would get tested in cancer cell lines, and it might show some activity that looks promising, and then it would typically get tested in animal models where you sort of work out some doses and some toxicities. And when it's ready for testing in humans, it is done in the setting of what's called a phase one clinical trial. Those sorts of trials are usually done in patients who have advanced cancer, who really have exhausted their standard treatment options. And the purposes of a phase one trial is really to establish an effective dose of a new drug. And once a dose has been established and the side effect profile of a new drug has been characterized in phase one trials, it then is moved on to what are called phase two trials. And in the phase two trials, you're really then targeting that drug in certain diseases. So in the phase one trial, it would just be done in cancer patients in general, any kind of cancer. But when you do it in a phase two setting, you're going to take drug X and you're going to test it in lymphoma patients, or you're going to test it in leukemia patients, or you're going to test it in breast cancer patients. Because now you really want to get a sense for, if I treat, 100 patients with disease Y and give them drug X, how many of them will respond to this drug? And you need to do it in a certain disease then. Those are called phase two trials. And once a drug has established activity in a phase two setting, then it may be considered moving forward into the phase three setting, where it might be tested against a drug that's been around for a while and has a proven level of activity.
Now, when you talk about these types of trials, these patients often, if not always, had prior treatments. They have advanced type situations. But even in a phase one study, do patients ever benefit from the treatment itself, or are they just participating in it to help future patients?
Occasionally, patients will derive clinical benefit from phase one clinical trials. To be honest, that is not the normal situation, because probably if you look at the history of phase one trials, most of the phase one drugs don't pan out in phase two testing. So some patients will derive benefit from phase one trials, but not the majority.
Although I guess at some point there must have been a phase one study for rituximab, for example.
Exactly.
And those patients, I guess, benefited.
Exactly. In the phase two setting, it's certainly true that lots of patients have derived lots of benefit from phase two trials. And for it to be a phase two trial, it doesn't just have to be a brand new drug tested in new disease. What it might be is you might take a regimen that has proven activity and works 40% of the time, and then you might combine that regimen with new drug X, and that's your phase two study. So in that case, let's say that the regimen that works 40% of the time is the best regimen there is in that disease. Maybe that is the standard. And in that case, this phase two trial, which has the standard regimen plus new drug X, that might be the first treatment that patient ever receives. So there are many times where a phase two trial will be the setting in which a patient receives their initial therapy, usually in combination with something that has a proven track record.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Non-Hodgkin's Lymphoma Update.